Iconocast, episode 43, December 6th, 2012. White Supremacy and the Logic of Empire. The Iconocast is a collective project and a handful of radical practitioners separated by thousands of miles, each exploring the way of Jesus in the Empire. In this episode, Mark interviews Jin Kim. Jin is the founding pastor of Church of All Nations. Born in Korea in 1968, he came to the U.S. with his family at age 7 and grew up in Columbia, South Carolina, and Atlanta, Georgia, in multi-ethnic environments. He holds degrees from Georgia Tech, Princeton Seminary, and a Doctor of Ministry from Columbia Seminary. Jin has a passion for the ministry of reconciliation and a vision for the visible unity of the global church. Do you enjoy listening to the Iconocast? If so, please consider making a donation to help us continue our work.
Welcome to the first experimental video version of the Iconocast. For our first ever video interview, we're interviewing Pastor Jin Kim, and I'm just going to launch right in. You recently spoke at the CCDA conference, which was in Minneapolis, and unfortunately, I wasn't in the session to hear you, but I heard a lot of reactions and responses.
Oh, boy.
Mostly positive, and a lot of people were kind of looking at the ground, kind of vacantly, not knowing what to think anymore. But I pulled this quote, and I think it's fascinating. I want to read the quote to you, which it's always fascinating to have someone quote you to yourself. But reconciliation is the process of rejecting the horror of Babylon, the logic of empire wherever it is manifested, including here in America, and reconciling with Jesus Christ, the one who was crucified by an empire built on political, economic, and military supremacy. There's a lot in there.
Mm-hmm.
But the phrase logic of empire, I wonder if you could unpack. Mm. What's the logic of empire?
I think if I were to say it as succinctly as possible, it would be to draw from the Exodus account in the Bible, where you had an emperor, also mm-hmm. called Pharaoh, demand that the slaves make more bricks with less straw endlessly. Mm-hmm. Constantly more bricks, constantly diminishing straw. It's made it very difficult to do. So that these people were treated as slaves, and these slaves were treated as commodities of producing wealth for empire, and that means those who control the empire, Pharaoh and his minions. So whenever a society reduces people to bare bones existence, where they are endlessly required to produce at the most efficient rate possible, even to the detriment of human subsistence and dignity and hopefully flourishing, then you have the logic of empire at work.
We don't do that though, right?
Oh, don't we?
Well, I mean, some people would say, like, sure, we have our imperial past. I mean, mm-hmm. so people will name, oh, okay, that's terrible what happened to those African people, indigenous people, maybe some other people in there, not quite as bad, mm-hmm. but that's all in the past. We're not really about empire anymore. I mean, what do you say to that sort of?
Well, I think that, the indigenous people in this country mm-hmm. and the African slaves and newly arrived immigrants like the Chinese railroad workers and others always knew this place was an empire because they were treated as commodities and defrauded of wages and a living standard and all that. But I think what's interesting about the recent years mm-hmm. Beginning with the housing bubble collapse and then the Great Recession that we've had after that, is that a whole bunch of white people were beginning to feel the effects of the logic of empire. The whole mm-hmm. Occupy movement was basically a bunch of white people saying, hey, we're being treated like commodities. And, this is still a country that's driven by white supremacy. So the flip side of that is that when a whole bunch of white people complain, then, you know, ears perk up and
it makes the news.
Things begin to move.
Because those other people have been complaining for a while and we're used to
That's right. So right now is, I think, a very interesting time in American history where a whole bunch of middle to lower middle and under white people and historically oppressed minorities kind of have a consensus view that something is gravely wrong with the society and fundamentally exploitative, and there are those who have somehow managed to manipulate the politics and economics of this country for the benefit of the wealthy and powerful few, and that that needs to change. So I think it's an exciting time. Mm-hmm. But it also exposes the relative lack of awareness and critical thinking about the majority of white people in this country. And it's not that minorities are naturally analytical, it's just that they have to live through the oppression, and it's just a lot more obvious.
So you kind of threw out white supremacy, which usually when someone says white supremacist or white supremacy, they think of people with shaved heads that are white.
Yes.
That are maybe have tats and are angry, and they're a small, small, small percentage of the population. And maybe they live in the South. Like, there's these stereotypes.
Right.
And so then that doesn't touch on most people aren't white supremacists. That's right. The logic. So when you say white supremacy, you have an analysis behind it that's kind of naming some things.
Right.
But I would imagine that, I mean, maybe you could go into that and maybe talk about what do you mean by white supremacy, but then maybe what it is that's so hard for white folks to hear it being named.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, and we need to unpack it some. There is that traditional understanding of white supremacy as the Ku Klux Klan or skinheads in Idaho or things like that.
Yeah.
But what I mean by that is, and this is, of course, not something that I invented. There's a lot of...
You didn't invite white supremacy?
I did not, yeah. Thankfully.
That's good.
There's a lot of great books out there on this topic, of course. But basically that there's inherent superiority that has been conferred upon white culture. And the proof of that supremacy being control of the politics, the economics, and the military order of the world. So basically, white might makes right. White makes might makes right.
Gotcha.
Right?
Yeah.
And since white people are in charge of everything, and white people are capable of sending a man to the moon, then white must be right. Right? And I would also say that by that standard, in terms of white supremacy as an ideology, there are white people that are not white supremacists. And there are people of color who are white supremacists.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not making a hard kind of external distinction when I say that. White supremacy is a deadly ideology that dehumanizes and is the primary exponent of American empire. Right? Every empire has its fundamental ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fundamental ideology of American empire is white supremacy. But if China were to be the next great empire, in the, you know, once again, in the 21st century, if India were to become the next great empire, the 22nd century, for instance, they'd have a different ideology undergirding it. So it's not the worst thing in the whole world. It just seems to me the primary strategic ideology of American empire.
I mean, there's other things that I could think of that might be contenders for that spot. Like, so a Marxist would probably look at an analysis centered around capitalism as being... capitalism being the animating force of the American empire.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think white supremacy is, you know, trumps those other ones? Or at least, why do you put that more at the center versus some of those other things that might be a part of the whole imperial package?
Well, I think that challenge is a legitimate challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that does require some, you know, serious consideration. But the reason why I come down on white supremacy is because of the particular history of this country. In Europe, we had all kinds of people groups at war with each other for thousands of years. I mean, for thousands of years, what it meant to be French was not to be English and not to be German and not to be Russian. I mean, these countries were at war with each other endlessly, whether they were during, you know, medieval times into the Reformation times, you know, right up into the, well into the 20th century. For all kinds of reasons, ethnic, linguistic, religious. But when they came to the United States, they had a Pax Americana, right? An American peace among the European peoples that said, as long as we're not black, then we'll be white. So there were all kinds of people. Swedes were not considered white. Germans were not considered white in the 18th century. In the 19th century, Irish and Italians were not considered white. But each succeeding group of immigrants said, well, we know we're not, you know, English, but at least we're not black or red or yellow or something like that, but especially black. And so by having one common enemy out of which we make that contrast, there became this thing called whiteness, just really, really unique and peculiar. It's in a perverse sort of way, a pretty amazing achievement that a whole bunch of people in Europe who were at each other's throat for thousands of years would enter into this kind of detente, mutuality, even a sense of people, you know, ethnos, a new ethnos in America. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it was done at devastating cost, the dehumanization of all non-European peoples, basically. And so that even not only Irish and Italians, but even Jews in the 20th century were able to enter into whiteness. It may be that, you know, lighter-skinned immigrants like myself, like East Asians, might also one day be considered white, you know. But it always requires a common enemy, a common focus of hatred like blackness. And so, yes, there are white capitalists and white Marxists and whatever else, but the most important dividing line that has meant the difference between some semblance of freedom and opportunity and the lack thereof has been the color line. Mm-hmm. Not ideology, not political affiliation or economic theory in this country, as far as I can see in the last 400 years.
How do you see white supremacy playing out in the context of church? You know, you said that you didn't invent this analysis, but at the same time, and I listen to lots of Christian folk, and there aren't a lot of Christian folk out there, especially in church leadership, within mainline denominations, naming white supremacy, talking about it much at all, which is why I'm drawn to you, because it's an analysis that isn't really getting into the church very much.
Right. There's still a pretty strong disconnect between the academy and the church in that regard.
And so how do you see this the logic of empire, which takes, you know, all sorts of military, political, economic shape, but is if you're centering it on the creation of whiteness and the myths around that in our country, how does that play out within the American church? What does that do to our Christianity?
Right. Well, when I talk about the logic of empire, I'm very intentional about the word logic, which comes from the word logos. The logic of empire is exactly the opposite of the logos of the kingdom. So we're either going to adopt worldly logic or we're going to adopt Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior from empire. But it seems to me that ever since Constantine and basically throughout Western church history, that the logic of empire and the logos of God were merged and fused into one. I can't think of two things more diametrically opposed, logic and logos, and yet those things became one in the West. So, you know, way before America ever existed as a political state, we've had this problem of the merger of church and state, of the logic of empire and the logos of God, fusing into this one grotesque thing called the contemporary church. So if the church is going to have any integrity as the church of Jesus Christ, meaning the body of Jesus Christ, then I think we need to make a very sharp distinction between what that looks like. What does the logic of empire look like? And how does it take shape in our lives? One way I see it is this understanding that there is a limit to our resources, and we need to exploit it to the maximum degree now while we can. Because there are maybe other empires who are competing for the same resources.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I understand and even have some sympathy for how American Christianity developed. You know, we are in a colony of the British Empire, right? When Spain decided to send out Columbus and to explore some way to get to India in a faster way for trade, and they inadvertently discovered the New World.
Oh, there's a couple of continents here.
Yes, and I think Columbus thought for like over 15 years that he actually had discovered India, right? Men have a hard time admitting when they're lost.
Yeah.
But Spain, all of a sudden, was flush with gold and silver and resources by being the first one out to exploit, you know, again, at the cost of lives and civilizations in other parts of the world. But that meant that the Spanish got to build an armada greater than any fleet ever on the face of the earth. And now they were a threat to all the other European nations. So the British had to build their fleet, and then the Dutch had to build their fleet, and the Germans and the Russians and the Italians. So there was kind of an intra-European competition. If they did not go and find gold somewhere else in the world, they just might become a colony of Spain and later the colony of Great Britain. So I think it wasn't primarily, in my opinion, the original motivation was not to exploit non-Europeans around the world. The main concern was not to be exploited by fellow Europeans. But that had the effect of everyone competing with each other for a land grab, resource grab, and that meant the annihilation of all kinds of indigenous peoples all over the world so that European nations can protect themselves from each other. Mm-hmm. And that kind of mentality, I think, persists to this day.
You know, I've heard you say that empire is fear.
Yes.
That's the reason that we have empires at all isn't because they're sinister people in back rooms plotting the destiny of the world, although there's enough of that, I'm sure,
yes,
that goes along among a certain set of society. But it's because the rest of us are so fearful that we're willing to allow this to happen to secure ourselves, right?
Right.
So, I mean, that's some of that logic, I think, has found its way into the church.
Mm-hmm.
It tends to drive things quite a bit.
In my opinion, empire is the logical conclusion of evolutionary survival instinct, right? So we're all wired, all creatures on this earth, to survive as long as we can and to pass on our genes as widely as possible. And human beings are not immune from that force. And we tend to want to perpetuate ourselves and our progeny. And that means that we kind of favor people that look like us, talk like us, think like us, as a way of protecting ourselves from malevolent forces that might want to wipe us out. But that means we make alliances, mm-hmm. and where we can't make alliances, we just conquer. But we keep expanding our borders and building arms to protect those borders so that we remain safe and we can perpetuate the survival of the species.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, is the logic of evolutionary development. So we're just so bound to that. And you know, I think the human condition is quite tragic because for whatever reason, there are these creatures called Homo sapiens that barely can walk on two legs, right? I mean, our spines are so not built to last a lifetime, 80 years. To walk upright.
Mm-hmm.
We're just hobbled together. We barely function on two legs. And our neurological development is, I don't think, much more advanced than apes, right? We have such a strong fight or flight impulse. We fear everything. I have squirrels in my backyard. I've, you know, been in this house for years. Same squirrels. Whenever they see me, they just run away. You know, it just doesn't matter. They have such a fight or flight reflex built into them. And I think empire is the logical outworking of that fear mm-hmm. of being annihilated by outside forces. What Jesus does, in my opinion, is put a stake in the ground and say, we don't need to continue on this path. If we don't fear death, and we're willing to be crucified, then we can actually begin to create humanity in ourselves and therefore those around us. Mm-hmm. It's the fear of death and the fear of annihilation, it's the fear of evolutionary survival that causes us to be so inhumane to one another. Mm-hmm. How do we give up our lives for our friends, turn the cheek with our enemies, and therefore reverse the logic of evolution, the logic of empire, and bring humanity into our midst? Mm-hmm. And so in my opinion, Jesus is the one who leads us from evolutionary survival instinct to true humanity. Mm-hmm. He is the incarnation of God, which means human beings learn to be humane rather than acting like animals. Mm-hmm. That is the path away from empire into this understanding humanity as one big family.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. William Stringfellow and maybe others have said this too, that they define the kind of the definitive quality of a principality or a power as it's the fear of death. So it survives even if it has to suck up people and resources to get its mm-hmm. will. And with that analysis, then lots of churches, the church has become a principality and power in lots of ways.
Right. Well, I really appreciated, Mark, when you said at our conference that any institution that is primarily about its own survival has become a power and principality. Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. And I think that's basically what the conventional church has become.
Yeah. And in some ways, that's bad. I mean, that's a bad thing. You can think of church bureaucracies that suck up resources, and there's these endowments that they don't use for the kingdom of God that they do on. Mm-hmm. But it gets a little more sinister than that. And just another quote to yourself: you made this doozy of a statement the last time we were together, where you said that the local church provides foot soldiers for the American empire. Mm-hmm. It's not just that the church is kind of like this bad stereotype of old people and bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. It's that we're perpetrators in some ways, or we're providing the ammunition or the foot soldiers for the empire to exist mm-hmm. and thrive at all. Mm-hmm. Like, how does that work? Where's that coming from? What do you mean when you say that we're providing the foot soldiers or the local churches? What does that mean?
I'm not sure.
It's a great line, though.
Oh, well, I think that, who is perpetuating these policies of endless militarism and economic exploitation and corrupt politics in our society? I mean, the vast majority of the voting public in America claim to be Christians. Mm-hmm. We're the ones who continue to vote in basically structural injustice.
Yeah.
Day after day, year after year in this country. I think that people in this country, the leaders of this country, know that even if we were actually godless, we can never admit that. Not with the kind of rhetoric we have that undergirds our, founding myths, mm-hmm. unlike countries in Europe that have been around for a lot longer. And so we've co-opted genuine Christianity with a civil religion mm-hmm. and have merged God and country and mom and apple pie and all that. And that whole package means that we have to understand America to be a special nation called by God, the special servant of God, to demonstrate to the world some kind of redeemed national life. And that God, even though there were people already here, Mm-hmm. And even though, you know, black people came from Africa and people came from Asia and other places, God chose white European descendants who banded together, unlike in Europe, and to forge a new people, and that these white people are supposed to show the rest of the world how to live, basically. And if the rest of the world doesn't see America as the gift to humanity that we are, then we're going to take our guns, germs, and steel, to quote from Jared Diamond, and impose our goodness on the world, which is not a very democratic thing to do, but very reminiscent of...
We do it in the name of democracy, though.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's really what... I mean, so Pax Americana, American peace, is very close to Pax Romana. The Romans will spread their Hellenized civilization to the world as a gift to the world. And if you don't want it, well, we're just going to go in and force feed it to you because it's for your own good. We have that kind of self-understanding, which we think is good, magnanimous, almost disciplined. You know, even though you don't think it's good for you, we know it's good for you. We're going to force feed it to you. So it's a very patronizing kind of an understanding that I think many Americans have about our country, which is why when we go against, you know, democratic practices to impose American values in other countries, we really don't have that much of a problem. Because in addition to having some democratic values, we're also fundamentally Machiavellian in our approach, mm-hmm. where the ends justify the means.
Yeah.
So that, again, also is a way of empire, isn't it? Jesus said, the way is the way to the truth, which leads to the life. Mm-hmm. The way must be the way of Jesus. And so when his disciple Peter cuts off the ear of the centurion and about to wage, you know, real battle, Jesus says, no, even though I oppose the Roman Empire, this is not the way. Mm-hmm. And I think the way of Jesus is not taken seriously in a society that fundamentally believes that the ends justify the means.
Yeah. And it seems interesting, like, if you start talking about this stuff, to me it has everything to do with the gospel, to name these things. Mm-hmm. But churches, like you were saying, this mythology that we have around ourselves being the city on a hill,
yes.
that's being fed in some ways, not only by our Christianity in an abstract way, but behind the pulpit. Yeah, the churches are cranking out people who generally not only give assent to this, but seem to really be excited about it. about this empire building, what do we do with that? I mean, I've been to your church a couple times, and I've heard you talk a little bit, and I know that this analysis and critique seems to always be close at hand. You seem to be willing mm-hmm. to name this even in very uncomfortable situations. So, does it begin to? Do we talk about it? Where does that lead? Where does this
right.
take us?
Well, you know, we're Church of All Nations is fundamentally an evangelical congregation. Mm-hmm. And that means that personal relationship is serious, right? Mm-hmm. So the kind of the evangelical thing is to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And that's not as much emphasized in kind of a progressive liberal side of the church. We're fundamentally evangelical. And that means this analysis about empire and about white supremacy has to be personalized. There's a lot at stake as a pastor for me with how this applies to our congregation members. I see so many people personally enslaved by the ideology of white supremacy, especially our white members. It is an absolutely urgent matter for us as a church to help liberate our people from all forms of oppression. Mm-hmm. And I can hardly think of any form of oppression more devastating than white supremacy. So an example would be a typical... you know, young white person who grew up in relative privilege, good education, maybe has a college degree, some debt, maybe has a decent job, a car, and a place to live and all that, and yet feels so inadequate. This is the number one word I hear from our white members. I feel inadequate. Mm-hmm. And then they move on to talk about why they, you know, what they feel inadequate about. But I ask the question, you can't just say, I feel inadequate. That is a relative term. Mm-hmm. Inadequate compared to what? Because your life seems pretty good by the world standards. You know, there's all kinds of people in the world who would gladly trade their lifestyle for yours.
So there's a pathology there.
Yes. Yeah. What is it that you feel inadequate compared to? And then they tell me just exactly what. And then I say, oh, you mean you feel inadequate compared to white supremacy? That's what I help name for them. When they feel like they should, by this time, have money and power and credentials and the ability to control their lives in a way that they find to be ordered, mm-hmm. and productive, right? And they don't have that. Most people don't. Then they feel inadequate. They feel like a failure, in other words. And because what they've been taught is that if you're white, then you should have control in your life. And if you don't have some kind of semblance of control, then you've failed. Mm-hmm. And I try to help them understand that's just one ideology among many. And you don't actually have to buy into that. You don't have to actually have certain formal degrees and credentials and certain kind of job and certain kind of money with a certain kind of mortgage and certain kind of cars. You don't actually have to have that. In fact, for a Christian, real wealth is relational wealth. Mm-hmm. When you have all kinds of people love you for who you are and willing to take care of you and have that kind of mutuality, that's true wealth. Mm-hmm. But that is a very, very difficult concept for our white members to get, and even for our immigrants to get, who are aspiring to that kind of American dream, which is basically white supremacy, mm-hmm. right? So, in fact, the fastest growing demographic in our church are white people. Now, how are we a church that uses the term white supremacy in our public discourse, and yet it's white people that keep joining our church? I mean, granted, there's white people who leave the church because of that too.
Yeah.
But when we personalize it, and when we help our white members understand, you know, you're not the biggest victim of white supremacy. I mean, black people are. Mm-hmm. Black people are the biggest victims of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. But you're the first victim of white supremacy because you drink it from your mother's breast milk. Mm-hmm. Right? You're fed right from birth that because you're white, your life should somehow work out. Mm-hmm. Right, that things should be good.
Things
that
you have to look
stuff,
a certain way.
Right, you should have. You look a certain way, be a certain way, and have a certain standard of life. That kind of expectation is oppressive, mm-hmm. and it's also contrary to the natural order of the world. You know, in the rest of the world, you know, food is kind of lean in the wintertime, and then it's abundant in the summertime, and you have to flex with what's going on here. But white supremacy is kind of a climate-controlled existence, mm-hmm. where there's always this amount of resources for you, this amount of control, this amount of dominance in your life. And it's just false ideology. And it's very oppressive. So it's difficult to follow Jesus into a life of poverty, for instance, if all that you've been taught is that poverty is a curse, mm-hmm. and that poverty goes against your birthright as a white person. Or your birthright as an immigrant that's trying to live the American dream, which again is just a euphemism for white supremacy. So liberating Christians from that kind of imperial ideology, this false ideology, into the naturalness that is much more in line, I believe, with what Jesus teaches about the fluidity of human community and our connection to the natural world, I think really has nothing short of a revolutionary effect on people who begin to understand this.
Hmm. All this is kind of reminding me of this interesting quote that I found by Karl Marx. You know, mm-hmm. You're not supposed to quote him in the United States, by the way.
I know.
Unless you're in the academy. And it's this exchange he has with a friend, and it's kind of after some war, mm-hmm. talking about the collective shame of the German people. Mm. And he says something to the effect that shame is a revolutionary emotion. Hmm. That as people who, like the German people, or in this case, white Americans, or people that have bought into the American dream or the white supremacy narrative, is they can name the fact that they're feeling ashamed, which is a sense that shame is different than guilt, because shame is, there's something intrinsically wrong with me. Guilt is, I did something wrong, I'll fix
it.
This, you can't fix white supremacy. Mm-hmm. Not in the conventional sense. So there's this shame that crushes people. But like Marx would say, as we work through that shame and name it and are open-eyed about it and honest and confessional and push through it, then that's when revolution happens, which I find a very intriguing idea. Mm-hmm. But I would imagine, like, so you're talking about all sorts of things that are really heavy. And I know that there's a lot of white folk out there. I see them all the time. And I feel like sometimes on a bad day, I'm one of them who feels largely paralyzed by how heavy all this shit really is. And there's a struggle to name, like, to dismiss quickly, oh, yeah, I'm the first victim of white supremacy, blah, blah, blah. I feel like crap. I did something wrong. There's something wrong with me. I don't know what to do. I'm just going to have an analysis, who's aware, maybe change some language, and that's it. There's nothing else I can do. And so I'm just going to shut down because it's too much. Have you encountered that in your congregation?
Oh, yeah.
Like, I would imagine if there's a lot of young white folks coming, there's a sense of hope. Maybe this can get at something that this deep shame that I don't even know how to name. As their pastor, how do you walk them through that and help them get to that other side where there's still maybe a sense of the shame, but it's now like I can be a part of the kingdom of God, the unempire, challenging this stuff. How do you get to that point? Because I feel like the reason there aren't more people working at this in churches is because of how overwhelming that shame is. It's so overwhelming that the first reaction is usually defensiveness and dismissal. And then if people, you can get them to agree, then they're just shut down.
Right.
Is that your experience? How do you work through that?
Absolutely. I mean, shame and guilt are universal, I think, in my experience so far. But I would say that in these, massive ideological frameworks that we're dealing with, like white supremacy, the interesting thing about white Americans is not only that they feel shame about something like that. I mean, you're born into it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're born white. You didn't choose to be white. And you're born into this ideology and raised in it. You didn't choose that. But then because of the ideology of individualism, then now you're responsible for it. So now there's shame and guilt. But in other countries, there might be national shame, but there's not personalized guilt because they have a collective understanding. And they recognize that they are part of a system that they didn't choose, right? So I think that's what's really so pathological about American psychology is that people are just totally the victims of larger social movements and ideologies floating around them. And at the same time, they take complete personal responsibility over it because of the additional ideology of individualism. It's a devastating combination. So one of the things we do at Church of All Nations, because I'm an Asian pastor, and this was a Korean-based church, is we say, you know what? You don't have to accept individualism as your controlling ideology either. So we help particularize individualism, just as collectivism is also a particular thing, and say if you kind of wear it loosely, you know, nobody is saying you have to convert to an Asian person, but if you wear your individualism loosely and see that it's a particular way of looking at things, and also then understand white supremacy as the controlling ideology that you were raised in, but that's not your fault, then you can look at it critically and not just be overwhelmed by the personal responsibility of having been co-opted into that. It's not your fault, so don't make a big deal of it. One of the ways that I help my people make that journey is by testifying to my own journey. If you're in Asia, for instance, Far East, you might look at Canada, the U.S., and Mexico all as just one thing, right? It's easy to do if you're way over there. Or we might, now some people think Africa is a country, you know. And lots of people think that China, Korea, and Japan are indistinguishable.
They're still all the same thing.
Yeah. And that's just understandable because of our natural parochialism as people. But, you know, the Chinese and the Koreans and the Japanese, we cannot understand each other's languages. We cannot read each other's writings. We're completely distinct people. And one thing that makes Korean people unique is that we've been around for 4,000 to 5,000 years as a distinct ethno-linguistic cultural people that have been oppressed by China, Russia, and Japan, and more recently the United States, but have never oppressed others. Now, on the one hand, that makes us look pretty good. You know, we're not oppressors.
It's like the Irish in Europe.
That's right. Yeah. But mostly, we were too incompetent to form an empire ourselves. You know, so we'll make a deficiency into a virtue, right? That's a human thing to do. And one of our coping mechanisms as people that have been oppressed for thousands of years relentlessly is to somehow prove to ourselves and to the rest of the world that we are somebody. We're smart. We're capable. We matter. And so there's a Korean diaspora all over the world, not just in the United States, everywhere. And everywhere you see Korean people striving. The best education, the best jobs, teaching the next generation to be professionals and not day laborers, and striving to have the best houses and cars and all kinds of things that we are important and that we matter and that we deserve to be on this earth. What that means then is that since the West has had dominance all over the world for the last 500 years and not China, that we want to take on Western culture and succeed there. I mean, it's one thing to be the greatest Taekwondo martial artist in the world, right? But Taekwondo is a Korean martial arts. But if you're the best violinist in the world, that's something else. That's a European Western art form. And when a Korean person is the very best in that, then you've outdone
even the
white
people. Yeah.
You've basically climbed the pinnacle of white supremacy, right? That's why it's important for Asian children to learn piano and violin and not ancient Korean, you know, instrumental music, which is there too. Mm-hmm. So what is Christianity? It is a Western religion. And when we do that well, when we do supremacy there, then what we're doing is we're contributing to Korea's national rehabilitation project, right? It is a nation that has experienced nothing but national shame for thousands of years. So when we go out there as Korea's exponents and succeed in business and law and medicine and politics and religion and experience supremacy in the Western forms of all that, then we've just one-upped the West itself. Mm-hmm. So it's not enough for someone like me as a pastor to follow Jesus, who was homeless and penniless and had a bad reputation as a glutton and a drunkard and a friend of lowlifes. Mm-hmm. I have to go to Princeton Seminary or Harvard Divinity School or somewhere really elite like Bethel or places like that, you know?
Wait, Bethel? That's where I went to school.
Oh, is that right? Yeah, brown nosing is a special gift of the Korean people. Anyway, how do you think we've survived for 5,000 years? Yeah. So, we have to climb the social ladder in every field. Mm. And when we achieve in all those areas, ultimately we bring glory back to Korea. So Korean people are fine with me as a pastor, as long as I have the marks of Western supremacy and breeding and culture. But if I were a poor, penniless anarchist like you...
Or Jesus. I just called Jesus an anarchist.
Then... I mean, Korean people would not look kindly upon me. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's not the faithfulness to the way of Jesus that's important. It's that somehow all of us in every field bring glory and redemption back to the history of the Korean people. That is a shameful thing, Mark. Mm-hmm. That is a shameful thing for me to realize after living a Christian life my whole life, to realize, holy cow, most of my life has been spent bringing honor and redemption to my home country's national story.
By embracing white supremacy.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I too am a white supremacist. Mm-hmm. Right? And when I share that journey with people in our church, whether you know they're from Kenya or from Argentina or you know wherever they're from, they hear resonance with their own story. It's not the same story. But they can recognize their own striving for imperial imprimatur in their own lives, for social and conventional acceptance. And what a shameful thing that is. And so then following this penniless, homeless, bad reputation, Palestinian Jew actually becomes the route to true human dignity. Mm-hmm. Empire is what is degrading. Chasing after historical redemption or keeping alive the myth of American exceptionalism. That is degrading. Mm-hmm. That is beneath us. That is humiliating. Why do we need to spend any time propping up Korea's national history or America's own self-deluded mythology? Why do Christians need to do that? When our Lord and Master was someone rejected by the powers and principalities, by the religious authorities of his day, and by a foreign empire, he was rejected by all of that. So why then do we need approval from those very same powers today? That's the shameful thing. So I try to, you know, redefine shame and honor for the people that I lead. And I think that basically what we're trying to do at Church of All Nations, as a conventional church, we have all the marks of conventionality, is if we help insert, oh, this is dangerous language, if we help reformat, is that better, our people's software from an imperial software into kingdom, or as you would say, unkingdom software, I think it would actually prepare people to live a life that the Mennonite worker, that Catholic worker, and those kinds of radical communities where you have shared resources and shared life together make possible.
Well, I think it's hard because I was just hanging out with a friend yesterday and we were lamenting that the inability for people to kind of go there is largely one of imagination.
That's right.
Will. Because the world is, it's America, the world in general is not lacking for people who can do stuff. The U.S. is filled with lots of doers. Mm-hmm. But we don't imagine a world that could be that differently. So all of our agency goes towards perpetuating the empire. And so if you're successful, you're playing by the script. If you're not, you fail by the white supremacy script. But then, I mean, there's lots of imperial failures out there. Mm-hmm. The reason they don't rise up is because they still have their HBO. or their pornography, or whatever the anesthetizing forces. And even the people that are striving and successful, like I've experienced enough success to know that it still doesn't feel that great when you've gotten some success, when you've done well. You still feel alienated and broken.
Oh, yeah.
And so what do you do? Like, oh, I'm just going to watch a movie for a while. Mm-hmm. So it seems like there's this script that we're driven to try to follow, and if we don't follow, we have at least this sort of social anesthetic or anesthesia that helps us just to be numb to it all. And it seems like, you know, every immigrant population that comes into the society who might have struggle, they will quickly embrace our entertainment culture.
And there's levels of code in software, right? I mean, at the most basic level, it's just a bunch of zeros and ones. And to reprogram our imagination at that most basic digital level, that's very hard to do. For instance, if someone were to join Mennonite Worker and say, man, I'm going to sell all this stuff and join with forces with you guys, how do we know that that is still not functioning out of white supremacy? Right? Meaning, how can I be a hero? How can I be special and do this heroic thing?
Yeah, I'm going to be I'm going to be heroic in my down and out kind of radicalism.
Exactly.
Yeah,
which only proves that I'm morally superior to all the rest of you guys.
It's poverty superiority.
Yes. That is still a function of white supremacy. And one of the ways that I try to correct that in our people is say, okay, why do you need to succeed in whatever way that you think? Why is that important? Why do you need to be special? Do you know that there are 7 billion people on this earth just like you? Do you know that hardly anybody cared when you were born? And hardly anyone's going to care when you die. You know?
And you're a great pastor.
And no matter what you do on this earth, good or bad, most people aren't going to care because most people are caring about themselves. You know? Most people are concerned with themselves. So whether you do great or whether you do poorly, whether you have honor or whether you have shame, no one's really watching because they're all concerned about themselves. So once you realize that and you just recognize that life is about living and loving and being loved and caring for those around you, oh my goodness,
then life becomes so much simpler. Then you don't have to have so much stuff. You don't have to achieve. You don't have to prove anything. And that's exactly who Jesus was and what Jesus taught us to do. Then now we're entering into the way of Jesus. But the most important thing is we have to not think that we're special and that we need to perpetuate that specialness and that we need to make a difference in the world. All of that white supremacist stuff has to be laid aside if we're going to be a genuine Christian community. So it's not the external form, whether the church looks conventional or unconventional, whether people live alone or live together. It's just, as you said, bringing new imagination. And my goodness, it's very, very difficult to give up the sense that one is entitled to be special, which is the fundamental idea of white supremacy. And if you're white, you're automatically special. You just need to live into it, right? To try to convince white people that they're not special, man, I'm telling you, it's one of the most challenging things to do. And I get great resistance to that as well. But those people who get it and enter fully into it and embrace it, you see true liberation. You see remarkable transformation, right? A prophetic imagination is what I'm talking about, to borrow from Brueggemann. Mm-hmm. And then community becomes possible, real community. Community is caring for others, basically. And when everyone needs to be special, that is in direct competition with care for our neighbor. So how do we trust God? How do we really trust that Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior and that God will care for me in the ways that I need to so that I am liberated to pay attention to others, to care for others? But if white supremacy means I was born special and I need to be special and I need to have control in my life, then the care for others, it's not that that's not possible. It's that that's always in direct competition with care and perpetuation of my own needs and interests. So following Jesus, truly following Jesus and trusting in God's providence really means that we're liberated to do one thing and one thing only, care for the interests of others. And then you have genuine Christian community.
Do you enjoy listening to the Iconocast? If so, please consider making a donation to help us continue our work. There must be some kind of way out of here. Say the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion.